Accession number 4488, Reel 1.
Brigadier O'Flynn, Reel 1. I'd like to ask you, Brigadier O'Flynn, about your background before you joined the Army. What sort of education did you have?
My first school was a little, I don't know what you call it, baby school, I suppose, in Hammersmith, on the Mall, to which I went at the age of 6. And I stayed there for 4 years until the age of 10, and I managed to pass the entrance exam into a preparatory school known as Collett Court, which was the preparatory school for St. Paul's.
And then you went to St. Paul's?
After that, I, in due course, passed the entrance exam to St. Paul's, and I entered the bottom school, on the bottom form on the classical side in September 1920. And I stayed at St. Paul's for 6 years, where after which I went to the Royal Military College at Sandhurst in September 1926.
How long were you at Sandhurst?
The course in those days were for 18 months. The first term, called the junior term, which lasted from September to December. The next term was the intermediate term, which was from January to the summer term, end of the summer term in July. And the final, the senior term, was from September to December, when after passing out, I went home and waited with dread or trepidation till early the following year, when I received a notification of what one had been commissioned and the regiment into which one had been commissioned. But I might say here that one always heard before the official notification came out from one's tailors.
Why was that?
I don't know. It was always very interesting. One always got all information about future promotion, etc., from the tailors before it actually came out in the Gazette.
Could you choose which regiment you were going to go in?
Yes. As soon as one went to Sandhurst, then one started considering to which arm or regiment one wished to go, because in those days Sandhurst catered only for the infantry, the cavalry, the infantry, and the tanks. Gunners, sappers, and the signals all went to the shop or the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich. In those days, there was no direct commissioning into corps, or the administrative corps, other than the RSC. All people into the ordnance. Remy hadn't started. The military police and other similar corps were all officered by people who transferred from the line, cavalry, or technical regiments.
Which regiment did you choose?
I chose the Royal Tank Corps. Not from deliberate choice initially, because I wanted to follow the rest of my family into various infantry regiments. But an uncle of mine, who had been in the King's, who was also my godfather, whilst not a very clever man, he was no fool. And when I went to see him to discuss about possibly going into the Royal Fusiliers, which my father had served at the beginning of the century, he said, no, the infantry is dead. It'll be dead within 20 years. The future is with tanks. And he brought pressure to bear on me to go into the Royal Tank Corps, or to apply to go into the Royal Tank Corps. Fortunately, I had this choice. But when I went into the Royal Tank Corps, I was also very fortunate enough to be posted to the 3rd. In those days, in the Royal Tank Corps, the 4 battalions in this country, each individual regiment specialised in a particular sporting capacity. third, the third battalion at that time, were the army champions, both in athletics and cross-country. And as I was a quarter miler, and I had won the public school sports quarter mile championship when at school, I had a particularly welcoming reception into the Third Royal Tanks.
Did you choose the fact that you went into the Third Royal Tanks?
No, I chose the Royal Tank Corps, but it was intimated to me early on, before even the official notification came out from the War Office or from my tailors, from the adjutant, that they were looking forward to seeing me and hoping I'd be able to join them earlier than most of my contemporaries so that I could run, help them win the army sports again.
So what year did you leave Sandhurst?
I left Sandhurst. I passed out in December 1927 and was commissioned by notification of the London Gazette as from the 2nd of Feb 1928.
And where did you go after that?
After a month's leave on commissioning, in those days all young officers went to the Royal Tank Corps Centre at Bovington for initial courses, the first being a fortnight at the depot to learn a certain amount of detail about regimental history, and there's a special a drill we had in the Royal Tank Corps. It was really a crew drill. It was based on a squad of eight, because we, instead of forming fours and turning right and turning left, we advanced by crews from the left or the right, rather in the lines that the cavalry did, whatever they called it, I can't remember, but they something similar. And after that, one did a 10-week course at the driving and maintenance schools at Bovington, where I learnt all about the internal combustion engine, learnt to drive armoured cars, wheeled vehicles and tanks. And at the end of that course, after a week's leave, one then went on to Lulworth, where one did a 10-week tank gunnery course, which one learnt all about the mechanism and how to strip and repair and generally look after Vickers machine guns and the tank armament, including the pistol. But I think I should say here that when one left Sandhurst, one was a pretty knowledgeable about both the Lewis gun, the Hotchkiss gun, and the rifle, which were the weapons we really studied in considerable depth at Sandhurst, not only to operate them, but also to fire them.
What was the difference between a Lewis gun and a Hotchkiss gun?
The Lewis gun had a round circular device for holding the ammunition, and the Hotchkiss gun had a thing that clapped in on the top. The Hotchkiss gun was really the cavalry weapon.
Why was that?
I've never really thought about it, but the cavalry very often did have to do things differently, and very often very much better than the other arms of the service.
What sort of tanks were you training on at this time?
Well, of course, I didn't start to train on tanks until after I had completed my courses at the schools. When I joined the 3rd Tanks, they were a battalion on their own at Lydd, and were equipped very differently from the other three battalions in this country. The 2nd, the 4th, and the 5th were all equipped with the then Vickers medium tank. The 3rd had one squadron of that sort of tank.
The Vickers.
The Vickers. I think I've used the wrong name. I'll check this. My memory is rather failing me there. Anyway, the three tank battalions and one squadron of the 3rd had this medium tank, which was then the standard equipment of this country. In this country, B Company, the company I went to, had a mixture of Carden Lloyds and Morris Martells. They were the tankettes, so called at that time, which were, had been introduced by Martel, who subsequently became a General Martel, and a firm of called Carden and Lloyd. They were trying to produce a requirement for the army to meet what was called the light tank row. And the third company were the Rolls-Royce armoured cars. So my first 18 months in a battalion in this country was mainly on the experimental tanks, and I was always also fortunate enough in my final 8 months in this country to have be responsible for carrying out all the experiments with a device, a light tankette, which it then was, which considered to be a possible tank for producing smoke to screen off the advancing armoured formations. Because at that time, tank tactics were a little peculiar. There were two schools, or three schools of thought. There was one school of thought which thought that tanks should operate like a fleet at sea. Another school of thought which thought that the tanks should be the sort of fast-moving, mobile element of the army, taking over the role of the cavalry, but being able to do it much more efficiently because it could carry cover greater distances at greater speed and with a greater punch. I must say I supported that school of thought as a young officer. And there was a third element which regarded the tank as just being a slow, trundling monster to keep with the infantry. Well, of course, as the time turned out, you require both sorts of equipment. Not necessarily equipment, but you require equipment or tanks which are capable of providing the fast-moving mobile operations at speed and also at the same time giving close and direct support to the infantrymen, which we have achieved at this time.
Where were you doing your training on the tanks?
Well, this is rather extraordinary. In those days, the third tanks at Lydd were stationed on a shingle bank near Dungeness. And, of course, the only training we could do at Lydd, really good training, could be done by the Armoured Cars Company. And they had the most wonderful time. They used to float all over England and to the envy of the rest of us. The medium tank company could only do training on certain areas of the shingle, and each year they had to depart to somewhere in Eastern Command or onto the plain to do their tactical training. And the light tank company, which I formed part in those days, could merely do tank driving around the local roads, or a higher training, or a troop, or in those days we called it section, now it's called troop training, because a section in those days consisted of five armoured vehicles, whereas today the troop only has three. We had to move to Salisbury Plain to do our higher training. Now, I was fortunate in the sense that both my years, 1928 and 1929, I formed part of what was then the experimental armoured force, which at that time was a really important thing in the army in this country, because there were two opposing schools of thought. One is the modern school, which eventually conquered, because we had some brilliant people like subsequently General Hobart, Brigadier George Lindsay, my own commanding officer, Colonel Tim Pyle, and various others who were dedicated. They had transferred from their own arms and corps and regiments at the end of the war to come to the tanks because they realized the tanks had got a future. And it is to that very small band of enthusiasts that the armored forces in this country in the war became as supreme as they were. And as a young officer, a very enthusiastic young officer, I became very dispirited in my early days, having been persuaded by my uncle to join the tanks, because I thought it was getting me nowhere. It was very dull. And I was grateful that I had the opportunity in the third of playing about most of my time with these experimental pieces of equipment, because it did bring me into closer contact with many of these illustrious people than would have otherwise been the case. And then at the end of 2 years, I was posted to Egypt.
Where were you when you heard that you were posted to Egypt?
Oh, I was in Lydd. It was a normal posting. It was expected. I received, I suppose, about November, December 1939, a letter from Glenn Mills, the bankers, at that time who were also the agents, who informed me that they had been told that I should be expect to be posted in the early spring to an overseas station. Well, this was expected, I knew it, and it was great excitement that early in January I received a notification saying I was to go to the Third Armoured Car Company in Egypt, because this, I realised, was going to be a wonderful opportunity to envy my friends in the Third in C Company at Lydd, who had such wonderful times driving all over the country in their armoured cars. And so it was that in early April 1930, I joined the troopship Somersetshire at Southampton to set sail to Alexandria in Egypt. And on this ship, the Somersetshire was also carrying the 1st Battalion of the Wiltshire Regiment, which was destined to serve in Egypt. So as a result of that voyage, I got to know a large number of people quite well, whom I did not expect to see again when I got to Egypt, because I understood that I was going to Cairo to join the rest of the company.
What sort of things had you heard about Egypt before you went?
Quite a lot, because as a small boy, Egypt was a country that always fascinated me, and I knew quite a lot about the pyramids and the ancient Egyptians. And again, it was considerable delight that I actually received a posting to go to a country about which I'd been so interested in as a small boy. Why I was interested as a small boy, I do not know. I think it was because quite early on I took a great interest in military matters. And Kitchener, Gordon of Khartoum, had been particular heroes of mine.
Had you heard anything about military service in Egypt from fellow officers?
Not really, no. Because in those days, I think the young officer's attitude was somewhat different. He tried to enjoy his work and what he was doing at the time. And we knew that we were all of us, all my contemporaries, knew, my particular batch knew that we would eventually go to India or Egypt. I had hoped I would go to Egypt, and it was with great pleasure that I received that posting, especially as I already knew three people at Lydd, who had been with me at Lydd, who were also serving out there.
What rank were you at this time?
Well, I went out as a second lieutenant. In those days, on commissioning, you served 3 years in the rank of second lieutenant, the first two being on probation, which seems to have been forgotten these days, because when you were commissioned, you also received a letter drawing attention to the fact that if you failed to come up to the required standard at the end of 2 years, you could be called upon to resign. But I went out at the end of my second year and became a two pepper, as we called it in those days, no longer a wart, at the end of 2 years in Cairo.
What did a wart mean?
Second lieutenant.
And how many men did you have under your command as a second lieutenant?
Well, it wasn't a question of men. It was one commanded in those days in the Royal Tank Corps, you had a section commander. The section probably consisted of 40 people. Because organisation in those days was, in my opinion, very much simpler than it is today. You had a battalion headquarters, and three companies, now called squadrons. But those three companies contained all the men on serving in that regiment. There was no headquarter element. Every squadron bore a proportion of the chaps who carried out the jobs on the regimental and squadron headquarters. And I still think that is a very sensible system.
How did the men react to the posting in the Middle East?
Well, all the troops knew in those days when you joined. They were all regulars at that time, having done the basic courses at the depot and the basic course at the D&M school and the basic course at the gunnery school. A recruit did not go to the regiment, to his battalion, it was called then in those days, until he had got in about 6 months' training. So he was a very highly trained man, much more highly trained, in my opinion, than he is today. And so all those chaps knew that after they'd been in the battalion from a year to 2 years, they could expect to join one of the drafts, leaving the battalion in the autumn-winter season. Because in those days, battalions had to provide one draft for overseas before Christmas and one draft for overseas after Christmas. And all the soldier knew, the record officer would inform the battalion, for the man's information, that he'd be required to proceed overseas to India or Egypt at some period before or after Christmas. And the troop ships went, I think, every month or so.
Were you issued with any special equipment to go out to the Middle East with?
Oh, yes. One had, in addition to one's khaki uniform, one also had the Foreign Service dress at that day. At the time was khaki drill and the helmet. But that was the only special equipment one took out. One had no personal weapons in those days. They were all drawn from store when you wanted them. With one exception, every officer had his personal pistol. And that personal pistol, in my day, it was a 4.5.
A 4.5? What is that?
That was the pistol. I've forgotten. My memory's gone. I've forgotten. Before you had the 3.8. The 4.5 was a caliber of weapon. That was issued at Sandhurst and was your personal weapon. And it remained your personal weapon until 1939, when all personal weapons were withdrawn from individuals and borne on the regimental strengths. But up to that time, an officer's pistol was his personal weapon.
And apart from the clothing, there was no special equipment?
Not to the man. He merely took along his own personal kit. He had no other personal weapons. I mean, his kit consisted of the pack, cross belts, and all these webbing equipment, as it was called in those days. It was issued to him when he first joined at the depot, and he took that with him and kept it with him because he kept it up and cleaned it and polished it and everything else. It became his personal equipment, which he retained until he left the service, until it had to be repaired or mended.
Once you got out to the Middle East, how suitable did you find these clothes?
Very suitable. Now, of course, when I got to the Middle East, perhaps I could say that as we were sailing into Alexandria on a very cold April morning, we were told in those days, I've forgotten how, there was no tannoy on the ship in those days. I think that a bugle sounded. When bugle sounded, it meant certain things, and as the officer's call went up, and we had to assemble in the lounge. And there we were told that the Wiltshire Regiment would be disembarking as a whole unit at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. A few details for Cairo, who'd already been told they were going to Cairo, would be disembarking at 2 o'clock. And the rest of us and the rest of us who were due to go to Cairo would be disembarking at 5 o'clock to get the evening train to Cairo. But as it happened in my case, as the ship was drawing alongside the wharf, I saw an officer whom I recognized from my days at the depot waving frantically on the quayside to me, and I realized he wanted to speak to me. And so I I got as near as I could to the gangway, which had just been let down, and this chap rushed on board and said, "You're coming ashore here, you're going to stay in Alexandria with me. I was going to see the ship's adjutant." So he departed, and I thought a little bit of what I was going to do, and he came back, "That's all right, get your hand baggage and we'll go ashore now. The rest of the baggage will be delivered ashore tomorrow, probably." And though there, to my surprise and delight, I found myself in Alexandria, a bit bewildered, and so I was in Egypt at last.
What was your first impression of Alexandria when you saw it from the boat?
Well, I don't know. I'd expect to see sun shining and glistening desert, and all I saw was docks, which looked rather like a rundown Southampton dock. But after that, as I drove from the docks through the centre of Cairo, not to a mess that I expected to be driving to, but to a palatial villa just outside a place called Stanley Bay, which was a noted sort of seaside resort at Alexandria. And I was informed by Guy Thompson, who was my new section commander, that the other two officers, the other officers in the section, which included Guy Thompson, at that time a man called Ian Fernie, another subaltern, a two-pepper, and myself, we lived in a private flat for which we had special dispensation, as we had to do certain special duties in Cairo, which meant we could live in a private flat and draw allowances to enable us to do so.
Did you notice any special reaction among the Egyptians when your troop ship disembarked?
I don't think that the usual melee on the seafront, which is exactly the same as it is anywhere now. A great number of Egyptians shouting and screaming, rushing around, and one or two gully gully men tried to come on the ship.
Who a gully gully man is?
Well, he is a wonderful chap who used to meet all the liners and other ships going through Cairo. He used to come on board, dressed in his gala beer and his red tarbouche, telling his name is MacDonald or Mac something or other, and he'd then do conjuring tricks, usually with three egg cups and three little chickens. And also, of course, a variety of postcards, which he'd try to sell you. But otherwise, one didn't see many Egyptians on. No, I mean, they were just a young man's first impressions in a foreign land, wondering what it was all about, just full of amazement and excitement. And the first Egyptian I really spoke to was a chap who subsequently became my servant, or they call him Sofragi, a most charming chap. And from that day, I've always been a great admirer and very fond of Egyptians and all Arabs, because they're a charming and most hospitable people.
Was he at the villa when you arrived there?
Yes, he was there, and he seized my suitcase, and before I knew what was happening, everything was being unpacked.
Just to go back briefly, I wonder if you could tell me something about the journey out to Alexandria.
Yes. As I was going out, not accompanying a draft or taking a draft, I just sailed as an ordinary passenger. Now, normally at that time, most people going abroad went as members of a draft, because in the Royal Tank Corps, in the battalion, we had to send two drafts a year, as I think I've already explained. Now, in the early spring of that year, we had sent a draft of, I think, about 50 or 60 chaps to India. Now, when they left the battalion, that draft of 50 or 60 chaps was accompanied by two of my fellow subalterns who were being posted to India for service. And so those two chaps, I've forgotten what their names were now, but anyway, the senior was a draft conducting officer, and he was responsible for taking those chaps to the ship, for being responsible to them as long as they were on the ship, and being their local CO under the ship's commanding officer, until they got to the other end. He also had to take out all their documents. But as a chap sailing abroad, not as a member of a draft, my baggage was collected from my home in London by the agents whose name I have then forgotten, but they were the famous shipping agents. They used to take your baggage away from you, put it on the ship, and all one went with when one travelled from one's home to Southampton, and then by train to Southampton, was one's equipment for the voyage, which at that time was, as far as I remember, was one wardrobe trunk and two suitcases. And when I arrived at Southampton docks, the trunk and my suitcases were taken up by the dock staff and put in my cabin, and I just went up to the cabin. And when I arrived, I found another great friend of mine in the regiment, with whom I'd been at Sandhurst, Rupert Harding Newman, and two other friends from my Sandhurst days who'd been in No. 1 Company at the same time, both in the Cameronians. And that was a little party I had in my cabin, the four old friends together. Now, there was a distinction, because as a draft conducting officer on the ship, I'd have had a number of responsibilities. I'd have had to parade with my draft every day at 11 o'clock at ship's rounds, and I would have had to have done certain training with them and kept them exercised and amused and all that sort of thing during the voyage. But as a chap travelling with no draft, Rupert Harding Newman was in a similar capacity, we had nothing at all to do on the ship all day, except sort of be present at our particular lifeboat station every day when the captain had his rounds. And to my dismay, and occasionally, of course, about once every 5 days, one had to do watch-keeping duties. All officers, all subalterns on the ship, had to do periods of duties. I think it was about once every 4 days, 4 hours on and 8 hours off, when they had to visit certain parts of the troop decks every hour. Because in those days, the soldiers were travelling in troop decks in the bowels of the ship. Absolutely horrible. Especially when it was rough, one had to go down and visit them, see it all was well, and that sort of thing.